I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 2nd of July. Our guest this hour writes in a recent piece this sentence: how weird is the Iraq-Syria civil war? Consider this, not only is the U.S. increasingly involved in military support to Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and his Shiite sectarian government, but it finds itself in direct military alliance not only with Iran, but with Syria, too. We're going to talk about all that's going on in that part of the world this hour. He also writes that as long as Iraqi factions believe that they can win by fighting, the war will go on. In the end, perhaps some accord can be reached by which Iraq holds together, but that will depend on serious outreach by Baghdad to Sunnis and Kurds. Bob Dreyfus is our guest this hour, contributing editor to The Nation, an investigative journalist who specializes in politics and national security, author of Devil's Game, How the U.S. Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. He's a frequent contributor to Rolling Stone, The American Prospect, and Mother Jones. And we'll be welcoming phone calls as we analyze what's going on the ground, what's going on with all of these countries involved, what's going on with ISIS. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email, talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and you can find us at K Dunn Show. Hello, Bob. Thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So it is weird. It is really weird, isn't it? But it's also pretty frightening.
Well, I don't know if... It's more disgusting than frightening.
It is disgusting, too.
We're involved in this in the way we are because, you know, really everything that's happening in Iraq is pretty much the direct result of the American intervention there way back in the bad old days of the Bush administration. But for all the alarm and, you know, scary talk about what's happening, it's also possible to exaggerate, you know, the danger of this, at least, you know, the danger to the United States. It's a huge danger if you happen to live in Iraq, but I don't think many of your listeners do. So the talk that the United States has to, you know, get directly involved in this again and start sending troops and bombing Iraq and everything else is wrong-headed, and I'm afraid we're on a kind of a slippery slope now, at least potentially, toward getting more deeply involved in this once again, which would be really sad.
And certainly that's the way that the news is starting to present all of this, that we have this terrorist state. We're seeing videos of supposed members of ISIS who are saying we're really after the United States, that that's the big prize. We're worried about airline safety now. The whole direction of the news has changed in the last week, saying that this really is threatening to the United States. Why do you downplay that threat?
Well, I mean, there are bad guys all over the world, but not too many of them have either the intention or, more importantly, the ability to attack the United States in any significant way. I mean, for all of the supposed, you know, Islamist crazies and radicals out there that we've been fighting for the last, well, since 9/11, you know, very few of them have actually attacked us. I mean, you know, there's supposedly tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, if you listen to the radicals, tens of millions of Islamists who want to come kill us, but not too many have tried it, and even fewer have even come close to succeeding. So, in fact, most of the Islamists around the world have their own fish to fry in their own neighborhood, and that's particularly true of the people around ISIS. They you know, like Hamas dealing with the Israel-Palestinian problem, like the Taliban in Afghanistan, they don't have any great interest in coming to the United States or even, you know, necessarily getting the United States especially mad at them. They've got local fights to fight, and that's where they're engaged. Part of the point I was making in the piece that you cited is we find ourselves now, you know, weirdly fighting ISIS in Iraq, I guess, but supporting ISIS in Syria, or at least, you know, supporting the forces that are arrayed there against Hafez Assad, or Bashar al-Assad, the son of of the former Syrian leader. That just doesn't make any sense. I mean, we had the weird incident the other day where the Syrian armed forces, who, you know, we have been trying to destroy for the past several years, actually went and bombed ISIS in Iraq.
Yes.
I mean, that to me qualifies as really weird. We're on both sides of the same civil war. It has become one single big civil war now, and yet we're fighting on both sides of it. And that just it shows most of all the kind of the bankruptcy of the way we've been approaching that part of the world for the past, I don't know how long you want to say, but at least 13 years, and in fact, you know, going back decades.
Mm-hmm. The BBC today reports this: the radical al-Qaeda offshoot ISIS has told other Sunni rebel groups which joined the uprising in Iraq to swear an oath of allegiance and give up arms. They declared a caliphate in parts of Iraq and Syria and changed their name, of course, to the Islamic State. Other rebel groups, they say, are trapped between the Islamic State, which is taken over in their areas, and a Shia-dominated government they're fighting against. And the Islamic State has suppressed other groups in parts of Syria that it controls. So what does that mean? Does that mean that we're not going to have all these different rebel groups? I don't even know which ones we're giving money to or how we're supporting them, and if indeed they are related to ISIS. But if ISIS is saying we're the only one, you've got to give up arms, what does it do to the whole equation?
I mean, they can declare a caliphate and all that kind of stuff, but that doesn't mean to actually create a caliphate. I mean, they're making an appeal to, you know, other radicals, other Islamists in other parts of the world to rally to their side. But that certainly doesn't mean that they actually have the momentum or the ability to do anything like that. I'm not too worried that they're going to establish a long-term caliphate there. And even in the parts of Iraq where they're active, and those are certainly very, you know, significant chunks of Iraq where you have these Islamists active, they're relying to a great extent, a great extent, on the unhappiness among the rest of Iraqis, especially among the Sunnis, who are unhappy about the way Prime Minister Maliki has treated the Sunni minority in that country. And so, in part, the reason ISIS has been able to gain the momentum that it has gained is because they've got many allies among the Sunnis of northern and western Iraq, who, you know, are kind of rallying to their side militarily, but not ideologically. And so in the end, it isn't too likely that these forces around ISIS are, you know, going to end up being dominant in the scheme, you know, the grand scheme of things there. That's why I think it would be wrong to get too worried about them, you know, their caliphate and all the stuff that they're that they're talking about. But still, they can kill a lot of people.
Right.
You know, thousands of people can die, perhaps tens of thousands of people can die as a result of this. They certainly have, you know, died in Syria in huge numbers in the past years. And so it could get a lot worse before it gets better. And that's really the sad thing.
Mm-hmm. The Times had an interesting piece over the weekend about money that's going to ISIS, and I mean, it's a whole lot of money. They got money from this bank in Mosul, and they're getting money from contributions all over the place. If you have a lot of money, you can do a lot more damage, can't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, they do have a lot of money, but, you know, on the other hand, I mean, how much money do you need when you're in their position? I think that, again, you know, some of the early reports were exaggerated about the amount of money that they did get. We saw reports back at the beginning of this that they had, you know, somehow gotten, I don't know, hundreds of millions of dollars, mm-hmm. I think was the initial report. That just, you know, wasn't true. It may have been tens of millions of dollars, whatever it is. It, you know, a penny for these guys is too much, in my opinion. But on the other hand, you know, the scare talk here is really, I think, where we should be focusing. If we were really concerned about the threat of ISIS, then we would halt our support for the Syrian rebellion, and that would give the Syrian army under Assad, a free hand to go north and east and attack ISIS in Syria. That would not only weaken ISIS, you know, severely, but it would cause them to have to divert forces away from Iraq and back to Syria. It just makes no sense that we're pursuing this Syrian revolt after 3 years. It's now pretty clear that President Assad is going to survive. He's won, you know, major victory after victory in the battles there. It's a horrible, horrible civil war that's going on with over 100,000 dead, but he's not going to give up. And so unless we're prepared to go into Syria like we did go into Iraq 11 years ago, we can't win with this proxy notion that we can, you know, arm and train a few rebels and they're going to go take Damascus. They're not. They're not going to win that one.
Yeah.
You know, we're now using this crisis in Iraq to try to force Maliki to either quit in Baghdad or to rebalance his government and include the Sunnis and the Kurds and other dissident Shia in the, you know, to create a more democratic government, because he's certainly become an autocrat over the last 8 years. I don't think that's going to work either. I mean, it's possible the Iraqis might rally together, you know, in a parliamentary way to depose Maliki. They have the votes, but I'm not sure they have the organizational ability, because he can, you know, bribe and cajole and you know, offer them deals and so forth in order to hold on to power. As you know, they just had an election in Iraq at the end of April, and there hasn't yet been a government formed, and there may not be for several months still. Maliki is trying to hold on to power. You would think that somebody whose army disintegrated at the first sign of combat, who's lost a third of his country to an extremist rebellion,
yes,
would you know, not be able to continue as leader of that country under a parliamentary system. I mean, his term is now up, but, you know, he controls all the levers of power and the money and the oil and the army and the security forces, and so he's going to use that to try to hold on to power. And with us getting involved on his side of the civil war in Iraq, just makes it look like we're pro-Shia and anti-Sunni, and that, you know, that could just make things worse.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back for a moment to the way the news is portraying this right now. We did, of course, suffer this horrendous attack on the United States. We've had thousands of Americans die and many very severely wounded from participation in Iraq. We've had who knows how many Iraqis died. A lot of people have died for the wrong reasons, perhaps, many would say, because we shouldn't have been there in the first place. Nonetheless, we did have Al-Qaeda sponsored these horrendous attacks in the U.S. So doesn't it make sense that there would be some who were legitimately concerned if you have an organization that is being described as even more radical than Al-Qaeda, getting a land space as large as Iraq and being as vicious as they are, that indeed they could pose a threat to the United States? And maybe it's not entirely likely, but neither did we see what was going to happen in New York City as well. And so there is legitimate concern about what could happen. And by golly, we better figure out some way, I don't know what way, but some way to stop it.
Well, you know, that's been the great puzzle of the last 13 years, right? And you have to distinguish between the individuals who led the specific organization called Al-Qaeda and people all around the world who are just, you know, angry Muslims of whatever ideology. After 9/11, we waged a particular war against the individuals of Al-Qaeda, and we ended up killing most of them, including bin Laden, a few years ago. But you can't wage a global war against a general ideology, against radical Islam, whether or not you think they might one day become a threat to, I don't know, to do what in the United States? I mean, maybe they could send some people here with guns to shoot up, you know, the Mall of America in Minnesota. I don't know. Maybe they can do that. But we can't go to war all over the world to prevent that. If that happens, we treat it like what it is, a crime, and we get those specific guys who shot people, and we put them in jail, and we go after the people who supported them. When somebody kills, you know, 20, 30 students at a Connecticut elementary school, or shoots up a movie theater and kills 15 people, or blows up a building in Oklahoma, we don't go waging a global war against badness everywhere in the world. When Tim McVeigh did that horrible event, I didn't see any calls for a global war against right-wing militants and militias and everybody. You know, we arrested him and nobody else. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if ISIS will come attack us. What I do know is if we go bombing Iraq, if we go intervening in other countries like that, if we start sending more drones to blow up people that we don't like in all kinds of countries where there may be, you know, less than effective government, you end up creating more bad guys than you kill, because you're killing somebody who has brothers and uncles and nephews and you know, sisters and mothers and aunts, and they all get really mad, and then they create organizations like ISIS to kill people that they don't like. Mm-hmm. So I don't see quite the point of this, you know, waging a global war. There's no way that we can defeat ISIS. The Iraqis are perfectly capable, after some great amount of ugliness, of putting these guys down. In Syria, the government of President Assad is more than happy to be extremely ruthless against these people and wipe them off the face of the planet if we don't get in his way. It would be nice if we could sit down with Assad and get him to do it properly and humanely, but we can't do that. We can't overthrow him. We can't really change the Middle East into Sweden and Switzerland or into Alabama either. And so it is what it is. And it's just not the job of the United States to go fighting angry Muslims all over the world because we think one day they might attack us. So far, they haven't.
We're going to welcome phone calls. It is, when you look at all this, so enormously sad, isn't it, that so many people have died and we have spent billions of dollars trying to find those who would harm us, and look at where we are. It's just enormously sad. So I guess the question of this hour is, what can we do? What do you think? What can we do? Here's how you join our conversation. Our guest, by the way, is Bob Dreyfus. He's contributing editor to The Nation. He specializes in politics and national security, author of The Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. He writes for The Rolling Stone, The American Prospect, and Mother Jones. And here's how you become a part of this conversation. This is just so serious and so enormously violent and sad. Is there much that, or anything, the United States can do about this? What do you think? We'd like to hear from you. 800, particularly those of you who serve there. 800, although everybody's welcome, 486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. Our email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Let's start with Frederick in Appleton. Hello, Frederick.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just interested to know what Mr. Dreyfus thought was positive prophylaxis. So, you know, we're not the victim of, like, the events he quoted earlier, just, you know, kind of standing in the aftermath and saying, oh, what could we have done before a terrible event took place?
Well, you know, 15 years ago, we had no Northern Command. We had no Department of Homeland Security. We had no vast national security agency spy and surveillance program. We had no international drone program. We didn't have troops in the Middle East or Afghanistan. We, you know, I mean, for goodness sake, we've got all that in place. If that can't stop, you know, a few, you know, crazed bearded guys from attacking us, then that's it. Then we can't do anything. We've done already too much. We've spent way too much on unneeded security, on over-intrusive surveillance, on defense of the so-called homeland. And we should focus a lot more on diplomacy and on calming conflicts in that part of the world, which create anger, which in turn generates radicalism. So in terms of prophylaxis, I would say we've done way too much already, and it's time to wind down a lot of that. I would dissolve the Homeland Security Department, and I'd cancel the NSA program and a few other things, and you know, maybe strengthen the FBI and some of the intelligence capabilities that we need to track who's actually plotting against us, rather than, you know, every single American's email and phone call records and everything. And specifically in regard to Iraq and Syria, I mean, this is a, to some extent, a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia, who in turn have their proxies, the Shia for Iran and the Sunnis for Syria. We could do a lot with diplomacy with ourselves and our allies to get Iran and Saudi Arabia to start you know, realizing that this proxy war that they've been fueling has gotten out of hand. I think they're both scared about it right now, and they're probably willing to talk to each other about it. There have been some signs already that Iran and Saudi Arabia are exploring a way to improve relations. And if they do, the civil wars in Syria and Iraq could get much, much better really fast, because, you know, the two sides in those wars are, you know, largely inflamed by the Sunni and Shia powers that exist on both sides.
Tell me more about Iran and Iraq. You write about their strongly backing both Maliki and Assad. What is the military support from Iran in Iraq right now?
Well, as far as I know, there isn't any direct military support. I don't believe that Iraq is getting weapons from Iran, and I don't think there are any Iranian troops there. On the other hand, there are very well-organized Shiite militias, most of which, maybe it's safe to say all of which, have ties to Iran that go back decades. They go back to the Iran-Iraq war that started more than 30 years ago. And so the Iranians have been, you know, deeply, deeply involved in Iraq since the fall of Saddam Hussein, especially in building up alliances with Maliki, with Muqtada al-Sadr, the Mahdi army guy, with many other groups that were involved on the Shia side of the fence. And these are people that we put in power. When we knocked out Saddam, the United States, in its vast ignorance of Iraq, supported the rise to power of various Shiite political parties that were based in Iran. We supported that wily old wheeler-dealer Ahmed Chalabi, who was one of the main architects of getting American support for that war. And he's, believe it or not, he's being talked about now as a possible replacement for Maliki.
Is he really? Oh, my.
But he had very deep ties to Iran as well, and may have been some sort of, you know, double agent, because he spent a lot of time in Iran and talking to the Iranians before the war even started in 2003. So, you know, the last time they had elections in Iraq, it was Iran which basically put together the political coalition that became the Maliki government. They're the ones who you know, organized the political factions. They literally summoned them to Tehran and had meetings there to organize the new government. They have a lot more leverage over Iraq than the United States does. And recently there have been reports, I think confirmed by the folks over there, that say that the head of the Quds Force, the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, sort of foreign expeditionary force, the Quds Force, this general Soleimani was in Baghdad a couple of times and consulting with the Iraqi military about how to defend the capital and the Shiite shrines and so forth against these Sunni fighters. So the Iranians are very much involved. They're certainly the main force that's been propping up Assad in Syria, because he's another of their allies. And they will prop up the government in Baghdad and do anything it takes to keep it in place. They certainly have a lot more capabilities than the United States does at, you know, so many thousands and thousands of miles away. They're right next door, and they have countless people inside Iraq who speak, you know, Persian, and people in Iran who speak Arabic. They've got, you know, religious ties and family ties to a lot of these people. So they kind of know the lay of the land, and we just don't, even though we spent, you know, 8 years occupying the country. We didn't understand it going in, and we don't understand it having left.
Frederick, thanks for the call. Paul in Mayville, hello.
Hi. I was curious when the U.S. became the world's babysitter. Why is it the U.S.'s responsibility to make sure everybody else is behaving? Isn't that their own job? Shouldn't everybody's country be able to take care of themselves or police their own?
Well, you know, I mean, there's a lot of history there. It goes back to the end of World War II and the collapse of the British Empire and the rise of the Soviet Union as a world power, and the United States sort of carved up the world between us and them. And ever since then, we've been building alliances and creating, you know, bases, and that's all the history to this, right? So this isn't really something new. I wish that the United States would retreat a little bit. I'm not an isolationist in any sense of the word, but I do think that we could, you know, cut our military budget in half without blinking. We could reduce by 90% or 80% are military bases around the world. Why we need troops in Japan and Germany and, you know, so many other places is beyond me. But a lot of these countries, you know, who list themselves as allies, get a free ride. They don't need to defend themselves if we're there to do it. That's one thing. And the second thing is there's a lot of money in it. There's a huge military-industrial complex in this country that would, you know, do backflips to prevent the cutting of the budget or the reduction of American armament spending and things like that. We, as you know, we spend more money on our military than the whole rest of the world combined. And, you know, the trend is up on that, not down. So, yeah, we could do a lot less and you know, focus more on, you know, domestic problems, building our infrastructure and creating jobs and things like that rather than overseas babysitting, as you put it.
Thank you, Paul, for the call. Marcus in Green Bay. Hi.
Well,
go ahead, Marcus.
I don't know what region we're talking about here, but last night I was listening to BBC News, and the announcer was talking about world things, and he starts out by saying that the United States has urged restraint in the discovery of the three teens. And anyway, it just hit me so hard. I became so angry, I actually shut up in bed. It's like, so what I'm asking is, could you please help me understand who are we to urge restraint and who listens to us? You know, who does that? Who, you know what I mean? Like,
I didn't get what you said. We urged restraint in what context? With who?
The three Israelis who were kidnapped and killed.
Oh, well, yeah, that's a whole other story, I guess. I mean, I don't know if you want to get into a discussion of the Israel-Palestine.
Yeah, I really don't. We got enough on our table. But his point, who listens to us? And it brings us into the, if we sat people down at a table to conduct diplomacy here, do we have weight in any part of the world here? Are there people who are listening to whatever our advice may be it good or be it bad?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that the United States has been, you know, suffering a dramatic loss of influence around the world for the past 30 years. And that's partly because other countries are growing more powerful, whether it's China and India and Brazil or Russia and Europe or, you know, regional powers, you know, getting influence. So when we tell Karzai in Afghanistan to do something, he ignores us. And we tell Netanyahu in Israel to do something, he ignores us. And the same thing is true in, you know, many, many long, long list of countries. So there aren't a lot of people who are predisposed to listen to the United States. But when it comes to urging restraint, I think that is kind of the right, you know, thing to say rather than the opposite, which is to encourage people to engage in military actions that, you know, can then inflame crises. If you read President Obama's speech at West Point from last month, he said, war is not the answer, that we shouldn't always be reaching for the military to solve every problem. And I wish he would listen to himself more than he does, because I think his instincts are right, but I don't think that Obama knows quite how to say no all the time to people in Washington who are telling him to, in fact, reach for the military, you know, from time to time.
Who is he listening to? Because we had this one round of military advisors, and then in the last couple of days, we have 200 more military advisors. Who's telling him we need to send more people, and he's agreeing with whoever's telling him that?
Well, you know, it's a problem when you're a civilian president like Obama, who frankly had no international experience when he became president. You can say the same about George W. Bush or Bill Clinton. You know, these governors and senators who become president, you know, they don't know much about the world. They don't understand the military. They find themselves, I think, kind of overwhelmed by, you know, folks who, when he says, give me options, and this happened with Obama on Afghanistan, right, and the first time when he first took office, and the, all the options they gave him were, you know, you can either send 20 or 40 or 60,000 troops, and like, well, what about the option for no troops? And when they don't give you, you know, they say you have a choice between A, B, and C, it's pretty hard to pick D. And so that's the problem for a president. Now, I'm not being sympathetic. I think, you know, you do pick D often if you, you know, if you have any guts. But it has to be based on some understanding, and that means you need people next to you who really get it and who can, you know, go toe-to-toe with the people who are arguing for use of military force. And so that's why I said his instincts may be right, but unfortunately, you know, he's got a gigantic bureaucracy that, you know, he's managing, which has a lot of momentum of its own, and it's really impossible for one person, even the president, to change that. It really takes a grassroots political movement and a change in the political climate in the country that you can then, you know, grab onto. At the very least, Obama should be saying to these guys, look, 60-70% of the country don't want us to get involved in Iraq, so I want to hear some other options. You know, I want to hear some plans that don't involve the military, because that this time it seems true. I mean, back in 2003, there was a strong majority in favor of war that President Bush just, you know, rode all the way into the conflict. The support for the war in Iraq was very high back then, 70 or 80% of what I remember. Same with Afghanistan in 2001. This time, you know, people are sick and tired of war. And so, I mean, if he wants to, he has the ability to rally the, you know, public opinion on his side. But that takes campaigning, and that
takes... It's a tall order right now. We need to pause for a moment. Bob Dreyfus is our guest this hour. We're talking about the Iraq-Syria civil war, which is how Bob has described it. He he's a contributing editor to The Nation. He's an investigative journalist specializing in politics and national security, and writes for a number of other publications, Rolling Stone, The American Prospect, and Mother Jones. We're asking the question this hour, what do we do now in Iraq? What do you think? 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. On Twitter, @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls for our guest as we talk about Iraq, 800-486-8655. Hello to Linda in Washburn. Hi.
Hello. I'm calling with a comment and a question for Mr. Dreyfus. My comment is that I think we need to take a step back and acknowledge that there's no shortcut to justice. And once we look at the facts that we were led to war as a country, not by negligence in intelligence, but by deliberate lies, as the Downing Street memos provided prove, by Bush and Cheney and the whole Wolfowitz gang, we were told that it would cost about $100 million and essentially pay for itself. And my understanding is it's $2 to $4 trillion with a T that it's actually costing us at this point. And we also forget the 100,000-plus Iraqi civilians who have paid the cost, the ultimate price in death. I think that the only honorable thing that Obama could have done when he came into office and inherited this incredible mess was to acknowledge the lies that were told to the American public, the conflating of Al-Qaeda with the need to go into Iraq, as Bush did in Cincinnati in a speech, basically telling the people of the country that it was Al-Qaeda and that we needed to go to Iraq to get vengeance.
So what should we do now?
The only honorable thing Obama could have done at that point was to acknowledge it and start making reparations.
Bob.
Well, I mean, I agree with the caller that the war in Iraq wasn't a mistake. It's often, you know, characterized in the media as a mistake or one of the worst foreign policy blunders in American history. I mean, it was a war of aggression, and it was illegal under international law. It was a crime, not a mistake. I agree that Obama, you know, should have set up some sort of commission of inquiry and brought those people to justice. But unfortunately, that's not the way our politics works. I mean, he wanted to cooperate with the Republicans on his domestic agenda. Of course, that turned out to be kind of a joke. But, you know, he wasn't interested, unfortunately, in looking backwards and, you know, investigating what happened. Quite the opposite. He wanted to get past it all. You could say the same thing about Bill Clinton when he took office, is that he didn't investigate the Reagan-Bush-Iran-Contra mess the way he could have. And, you know, you could say the same thing about Jimmy Carter with Watergate. You know, he kind of let that one slide. I mean, that's the tradition of the American political system, is the previous guy's mistakes, you ignore them and let them slide. And
thank you, Linda.
Happened.
Let's go back to Iraq today. In your recent piece, you say that, looking at whatever hopeful signs we could find here, inside Iraq, new political coalitions could conceivably emerge to replace Maliki with a broader, more unifying government that would appeal to Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds. Is there any possibility that could happen? Do you see any of those kinds of negotiations or working toward that desirable outcome are underway?
Well, I think it's too early to say that they're underway, but I do think that the potential is. You may remember that 4 years ago, after the last election, the guy who actually won that election was named Iyad Alawi. Alawi was a former prime minister, you know, early on during the occupation time. He's a Shiite himself, but he has a strong base among the Sunnis. Even though he got the most votes, he wasn't quite able to put together a coalition because the other parties that might have supported him on the Shiite side of the divide threw their lot in with Maliki, in part under pressure from Iran and so forth. This time, I think maybe even the Iranians have figured out that Iraq doesn't really have a future as a Shiite sectarian state, and so they might be more amenable this time to some sort of more unifying government. And like I said earlier, I mean, that would partly depend on Iran and Saudi Arabia, and also Turkey, by the way, which has a lot of influence among the Sunnis, to work with their various proxies inside Iraq to get them to sit down and put a new government together. But so, yes, it could happen, and maybe this, you know, ISIS crisis has forced enough people to, you know, look in the mirror and say, "Wait a minute, we got to do something." It's the same as in Afghanistan, where, you know, there's going to be a new government there, a new president. It could be a mess that leads to civil war again, or maybe Iran and Pakistan and India can get together with their proxies and, you know, support a stable government there that the United States could help finance. It's up in the air in Afghanistan, and it's up in the air in Iraq. And these, unfortunate thing is, these are two countries that we shattered. And when you shatter a country and destroy all of its institutions, it's not really so easy to put Humpty Dumpty back together again.
Rich in Kenosha, hello.
Hi. I wonder if you could give us an explanation about the history of the petrodollar and why that's the basis of everything we've done with our wars.
Well, I don't agree that that's the basis for everything. It's certainly true that because Iraq is so rich in oil, it's, you know, maybe the got more oil than Saudi Arabia once the war clears out and there's a way to start, you know, truly accounting for how much is under the ground there. Certainly Iraq, you know, if it had no oil, would not have been in all of this this turmoil. But it's more than about oil. It's more than about money. There's so many factors that go into a war like that that, I mean, if anything, you know, between alternate energies and natural gas and fracking and all that kind of stuff, the United States is less dependent on the Middle East than it was 5, 10, 20, 30 years ago. We're less dependent on OPEC, on Saudi Arabia. The country that really cares about the Middle East now is China, because they're the country that needs to get its, you know, its oil and gas imported from Russia and the Middle East in order to keep its industry going.
Thank you, Rich, for the call. We only have about a minute left, Bob. One thing that I have had a hard time understanding is how in a very short period of time, at the most, I've been reading 10,000 ISIS soldiers have been able to storm through a country and take huge swaths of territory without there being any kind much of a fight, people just not fighting or walking away from their fighting posts. How could that be going on? Is there not a sense of Iraq?
You know, there isn't a sense of Iraq, but on the other hand, when we broke the country apart, people retreated to their camp, to their religion or ethnic group, in order to, you know, struggle for power. The reason why that small number of fighters could take over such a big chunk of territory is because they had the tacit support of people who are not ideologically affiliated with them, the Sunni tribal military groups and the former Ba'athists and so on, who are still strong in the Sunni parts of Iraq, were allied in a way with ISIS, probably confident that in the end, you know, they could knock ISIS for a loop and you know, but they're so angry at Maliki that they were willing to, you know, become part of this rebellion, and they still are. So it was a rebellion waiting to happen, and they just happened to trigger it and become the catalyst for a rebellion across very large sections of the
mm-hmm.
country.
Yeah, thank you, Bob, so much for being with us this hour.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
Bob Dreyfus, our guest, contributing editor to The Nation. He specializes in politics and national security, and he's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. He writes for Rolling Stone as well, The American Prospect, and Mother Jones. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson for producing this hour, and thanks to K.P. Whaley for on-air production. Almost dropped my pen. I did drop my pen. For production help here in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for your calls, everybody. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and then we're going to learn some history because some of the past, World War I, is connected to what we've been talking about this hour. So it's good to make those connections to know our history. We'll do so the second hour of our program. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.